February 6th, the 70th anniversary, right, of Queen Elizabeth's accession to the throne. It was, I didn't know about that until I read about it in the paper this morning.
Are you some kind of royalist?
You know, it's interesting.
Hey, Ruben. I read about it because you said Camilla was going to be queen.
Yes, or queen consort, so it was. Yeah, it was just interesting. It was saying that, strangely, she was in a treehouse in Kenya when she heard that her father had died. And oddly enough, Elizabeth I was also in a treehouse when she heard that Queen Mary had died back in the day. So there you go. And she was also 25 years old. Sounds kind of weird.
Well, somehow I don't picture Queen Elizabeth ever being in a treehouse.
Which one?
Do you?
Which Queen Elizabeth?
Well,
both of them, as it turns out. But no, she was in a treehouse in Kenya when her father... She was on a tour of the empire,
right.
And her first stop was Kenya.
It's in The Crown, that series.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Yeah, okay, yes. Yeah. But anyway, I thought it was interesting. So last week I had about 15 minutes of the class on there, as it turns out, unfortunately, only about 15 minutes. So I sat down in the basement and I recorded another 5 or 10 minutes or something. So basically half the time, but I reread the part of the stuff that had not gotten recorded and made a few comments. But of course we lost all the best
brilliant
part of the
insights.
All the brilliant insights. So anyway, let's recap where we are. I don't know if Warrenetta. I don't know if
I've listened to some.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Of course, what we've been doing is, you know, we've been talking about the will to believe, and it's once again it's comprised of 10 essays. It's really a collection of essays, is what it is. And they were published at various times. But and of the 10 essays, I divided them up into two groups. One is a group of 7, the other is a group of 3. And basically, they cover 2 main topics, the will to believe. So the 7 are on belief, and the 3 are on free will. And so we are in the middle of talking about the first 7, the ones on the idea of faith, belief, and so forth. And altogether, as I count them, there are 5 arguments that he deploys in favor of believing in religious belief. Let's just put it that way. 5 arguments. And I've covered 3 of them. The first 3, actually, I think, are very, very much tied in with the general pragmatic epistemology. The first argument, remember, I characterize as an elaboration of Pascal's wager argument, and of course everything on the board over here is related to that first argument, that like ethical decisions, religious questions or the religious decisions or options, let's say, as he calls them, are living, they're forced, and they are momentous, and you're better off being one who seeks truth and one who wants, before all else, to avoid error. The logical positivists, the ones that have the little narrow circle here, are paranoid about being wrong. So if you're paranoid and if you're highly risk averse, you're not going to go out on a limb at all, and you're not going to believe anything that is not, you know, absolutely scientifically confirmed. But if you're more of a seeking truth type, you're more willing to gamble on something a little less certain, just like investing your money, as I said. You know, so that was the first argument. The second argument was the one about the leaping over the chasm. That was the leaping over the chasm. And I was, you know, and I can't remember. This week I said to Patty, I forget what it was, but it was, I think it was something in the news. And it reminded me of that chasm business. But I do remember another article that I read about 2 weeks ago that reminded me of William James also, and that had to do with developing hypersonic missiles. And apparently the reason we are lagging behind that is because we gave it a little, at one point the U.S. was in the lead, it said. And we gave it a little try and had a couple failures and got all discouraged and didn't really pursue it. And the point is, if you really think you're going to succeed, that will be an impetus to keep trying until you do succeed. And it will be the reason you do succeed, because I'm confident that I can succeed, right? So if you are come to this chasm in the Alps, as he says, and I don't know if I can jump it or not, you very likely might not make it. But if you are confident that you will, you'll increase your chances. So the point he's making there is that belief is not, it's not the case that the world is what it is and my beliefs are simply a reflection of it, but it's a two-way kind of thing, that belief can also influence the way the world is, namely my, in this case, success in jumping over the chasm, right? And then the third argument, which I think is the most interesting of the lot, and it's the most interesting of the lot because it clarifies. Remember, I keep on complaining. I was complaining over and over and over again when we were doing the theory, the pragmatic theory. I kept on saying, you know, it's just so darn vague and seemingly almost sometimes even contradictory. I mean, you know, you get this idea that, oh, this is what he's saying, and the next thing you know, you'll read a sentence that says, that's not what I'm saying, I'm saying this. You know, what are you saying? Because sometimes he talks like a positivist, and you think, oh, well, we're now in the narrow circle range. And then next thing you know, he says, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying blah, 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 you know. And when all is said and done, of course, that's what led me to draw this horrible-looking circle here. But, of course, I ran out of room. So that's why it's more of an oval. But, you know, you get the point. It's a much more capacious. What counts is evidence for William James. And this is what the major argument is. What counts is evidence is a lot more inclusive than what, well, at the other extreme, a logical positivist would say. And, you know, finally we have a sort of a concrete case here in argument number three, which is in that essay called Reflex. Did you read that one, Tom? Reflex,
yes,
Action and Theism? Yeah.
The previous one was better.
What was the previous one? You mean the one, the living, is it, whatever it is?
This one was better.
Is life worth living?
Yeah.
That's true. I mean, the one that Tom talked about before was Is Life Worth Living? Yeah, you're right. There is, I mean, the Reflex Action and Theism is like essay number five or something. I forget what the order is, but at any rate. But that is, it gives us, you know, it's fine to make a general claim. That's good. But I know as a longtime teacher, it's not you out there listening. If I make some sort of abstract claim, that's okay. But it sure helps if you're a teacher to give a concrete example of what you're talking about, so people can kind of get a, well, as Aristotle says, you know, every abstract idea has a phantasm that goes along with it, a mental picture that goes along with it. It's the same kind of thing here. It's fine to have the theory and say, yeah, this big circle is where we're at and so forth and so on. But it's even better to have an example of the kind of thing he's talking about. And lo and behold, in Reflex Action and Theism, that's exactly what he does. And, it's over here. I'm looking for it. And he says, look, he says, there are three faculties in the soul, as it were. Sally, I see you can't even see this part of the board.
Oh, I'm fine. I can move my head.
Well, anyway, it says perception, thinking, and willing. And his point is, now, of course, the logical positivist, I keep on contrasting him with the logical positivist, but the logical positivist would just say, well, you know, all I'm interested in is this part here, perception and thinking. Because, of course, for the logical positivist, there are indeed two ways of verifying a proposition. Either it's a proposition that can be reduced to observations, in which case perception is the key. If I have a theory and I say, well, as a result of this theory, these observations should hold, and I go out and look, And in fact, that's what I find. Well, that helps confirm the theory. Of course, if I don't find it, it falsifies it. But anyway, that's the point, that some propositions can be expressed in terms of, as they said, observation statements, and that would bring perception into question. The other way of confirming something is like in mathematics, where we prove a theorem on the basis of, you know, deductively from axioms and rules of inference and so forth and so on. And that's not a matter of observation, that's a matter of deductive reasoning, but that's okay too, you know, for them. You know. But then James adds to those two, the perception of thinking, he adds this third one, willing. And he says, look, I drew an analogy to the ancient Roman tribunes. Well, you know, where a tribune, the Senate could pass something and the tribune say, veto, meaning I forbid it. I veto it. And it's like all three of them have got a veto. Not just two of them, but three of them. And that's his whole point, is you got to pass muster, or put it this way, not necessarily, well, that's, maybe you shouldn't put it negatively, maybe you should put it positively. There are three, as it were, presidential advisors that have an input into the eventual decision by the president being me or you, but these advisors are your perceptional faculty, your thinking powers, and also willing. Your willing.
See? Willing?
Yeah.
Willing.
No, Don, don't you know there's a devil on one shoulder and an angel on the other? It's only two.
Right? Yeah. Well, there's something up here. Or actually, remember
oh, yeah,
I said
gut feeling. Oh, nice recovery there, Don.
I said gut feeling. I mean, I have that in parentheses. Because willing per se, I don't know. You know, the question came up, well, does that mean that I somehow will God into existence? That doesn't make any sense. But if willing is part of a more generic kind of thing, once again, I think I cited Aristotle and his idea of, I mean, the closest thing to will you get in the Comachean Ethics is the idea of practical wisdom, which is deliberation. And, you know, you do indeed often deliberate on the basis of gut feeling. If you've had a lot of experience with this situation in the past, and I encounter yet another instance of it, I draw on my previous experience, but it is more of just, you know, I don't think about it that much. I mean, I do, I consciously think about it, but I mean, I don't work through all the possibilities because I've encountered it a bazillion times in the past, so I just have this general feeling about what I ought to do, and I do it. I think it's got to be something like that, right? But the big point is this. Right. Despite the fact that he's vague and contradictory seemingly all the time, and stating the general principle in what I've called his theoretic works, such as Pragmatism itself, the series of lectures called Pragmatism. Despite that, now we have a concrete example of the kind of thing he's thinking about. I think it's very, very helpful. And so if I were to summarize exactly what he wants to say, is what counts as evidence needs to be expanded beyond just what the logical positivist would say, i.e. perception or thinking. But there's this gut feeling that we have that also is a presidential advisor and has influence as to what ought to be accepted and what ought to be rejected. And so we sort of, as human beings, we sort of rebel, a normal human being, you might say, rebels against the meaningless universe.
Like this girl.
A normal human being rebels against a meaningless universe. And it is natural to have an optimistic view of things, despite the fact that there are setbacks galore, but there's this overarching context that we like to think exists that where the setbacks are tactical losses, but strategically, the good wins out over the evil, right? Just like in The Lord of the Rings. We watched that a couple of weeks ago, and I hadn't seen it for quite some time. It's been even longer since I read it. But, you know, there were surely a lot of tactical setbacks in that movie. But, of course, strategically, you know, good won out over evil. And I think James is simply saying human beings just have to react that way. They have to orient themselves in that respect to the world in general. You know, that's a matter of willing, as in this very broad sense. It would include gut feeling, right? So that's a long summary of where we are. But that third argument, I think, is really the most interesting of the lots, mostly because it does help to flesh out what that abstract theory of pragmatism is all about. If you're talking to your friends and you say, well, you know, William James held that that practical effects, rather than some sort of narrow logical positivist kind of thing, practical effects need to play a role in your beliefs. And your friend says, well, what is that? All sorts of things have practical effects. Then you say, well, okay, what I mean is, you know, there's perception, there's thinking, but there's also this kind of feeling that we have that also is one of the, provides one set of inputs into what we believe. That's the cash value of that abstract theory. I think it's really important for that reason. So remember that one. If you don't remember the, of course, the jumping across the chasm, I think, is an easy one to remember too, but because that's a, you know, very visual sort of thing. But yeah. So anyway, we're on to argument number four. I mean, of the five. No. What color?
Four.
I've got to find the right color here. Hang on. It's this one.
Diane, you need to mute.
Okay. Now, by the way, so the next two arguments are not as intimately intertwined with his pragmatic theory. The first three arguments, as I said, are very closely, I think, aligned with the theory. The next two arguments are pretty independent, I think, anybody, not necessarily a pragmatist, could make the next two arguments. I am labeling them, respectively, the moral argument and the mystical argument. Now, I will ask... oh, hi. Just in time. I finished my summary, so I'm on to the next thing now. So, Marty, I have a question for you. Tell us about...
Okay.
Tell us about C.S. Lewis's ethical, moral argument for the existence of God. Because you have mentioned it many times, I think, haven't you?
Yes. As I remember, he thinks that because we know, humans know the difference between good and evil, between right and wrong, even though we may do wrong, that proves the existence of God, because where else would we have gotten that knowledge?
Excellent.
Except from God.
Exactly. And I will also add to C.S. Lewis, Riley Williams as a proponent of that argument, because he probably doesn't even remember this, but long ago, and this is quite some time ago, we were both at work camp, and this was back when we went to Grand Rapids. A couple of summers I was with the work camp group at Grand Rapids, and we were coming back together in his car. He was driving, and of course we got to talking about theology and so forth, and he said almost the same thing that Marty just said, right? You got to be religious, because otherwise where do these moral demands come from, is the idea. Now, if you ask Don Ross, you know, my opinion on it, I am not one of those who thinks that the only possible source for ethics is religion. But certainly that argument is frequently made, as you just heard, by both thinkers, by both C.S. Lewis and Riley Williams, okay? And also William James. That's why I That's why I asked Marty that question, because as it turns out, James makes a similar argument here, but with a particular cast to it that's rather unique here. In fact, as you will hear...
Wait a second, Don. He never says he proves anything.
Oh, well, okay. We're talking about, though, tipping the scales in favor of belief.
He keeps saying, if you believe there's a God, it would be like this. Well, here's why you might believe in God. Mm-hmm. He doesn't say, therefore there is a God.
Well, I think he does, but it's not a proof in the sense of a medieval Thomas Aquinas kind of, you know, demonstration that God exists. But I think what he's saying is, here's the needle, and it's on zero right now, and the question is it going to go over to the minus, or is it going to go to the plus? And there are considerations that tip it to the plus side. That's the way I read it anyway. I mean, he's trying to give
that's
us...
That's a lot weaker than what Marty just said from C.S. Lewis.
Well, listen to what James says. And as I was going to say, what's unusual about this... I mean, of course, the way C.S. Lewis puts it is a little bit different from the way Riley Williams puts it. And the way James puts it is a little bit different from the two of them, too. So listen to the peculiar flavor of James's way of putting it, which is surprisingly Hobbesian. It really is. But anyway, I'm going to read a few paragraphs and you'll pick it up at some point. It doesn't come out at the very beginning, but let me start it off.
Which writing is this out of?
This is out of the moral... This is The Will to Believe, mm-hmm. which is a collection of 10 essays, but this particular essay is titled The Moral Philosopher. So it is clearly centered on ethics. Yeah, thanks for asking. I forgot to mention that. The moment one sentient being, however, is made a part of the universe, there is a chance for goods and evils really to exist. Okay, right? Because we are more sentient beings, and we are cognizant of good and evil. Moral relations now have their status in that being's consciousness. In other words, we are aware of moral values. So far as he feels anything to be good, he makes it good. Okay. It is good for him, and being good for him is absolutely good, for he is the sole creator of values in that universe. And outside of his opinion, things have no moral character at all. Well, that sounds, as I said, very Hobbesian, right? I mean, remember Hobbes says, I love the way Hobbes puts it, and I don't think I certainly can't quote it word for word, but it's something like, good and evil have their character in what someone either desires or despises. There being no such thing as good or evil absolutely, or something like that, except he puts it better than I just did. I like to quote Hobbes because he's such a good writer, but you get the point. That's what, amazingly, William James is saying here. You know, good and evil, he says, don't come from the universe at large. The universe at large is completely indifferent. It just is. It is what it is, right? Sentient beings, that's going to become important, sentient beings create good and evil because we value certain things and disvalue other things, okay? All right, let's go on. Since the outcome of the discussion so far... I thought I had something back here. I guess I didn't. Okay, yeah. Since the outcome of the discussion so far has been to show that nothing can be good or right except so far as some consciousness feels it to be the good or thinks it to be the right, we perceive on the very threshold that the real superiority and authority which are postulated by the philosopher to reside in some of the opinions and the really inferior character which he supposes must belong to others cannot be explained by any abstract moral nature of things existing antecedently to the concrete thinkers themselves with their ideals. Okay, this is saying the same thing in other words. like the positive attributes, good and bad, the comparative ones, better and worse, must be realized in order to be real. If one ideal judgment be objectively better than another, that betterness must be made flesh by being lodged concretely in someone's actual perception. It cannot float in the atmosphere, for it is not a sort of meteorological phenomenon like the aurora borealis or the zodiacal light. Its esse is percipi. In other words, to be is to be perceived. More Latin thrown in there. That's Berkeley. Like the esse of the ideals themselves, but between which it obtains. In other words, it's not going to have any being unless somebody, that is moral ideals, will not have any being unless somebody values them. They're not in the universe at large, right? He puts in quotes, right, that is not in, quote, the nature of things, in what I read a few sentences ago. The philosopher, therefore, who seeks to know which ideal ought to have supreme weight and which one ought to be subordinated, must trace the ought itself to the de facto constitution of some existing consciousness behind which, as one of the data of the universe, he as a purely ethical philosopher is unable to go. This consciousness must make the one ideal right by feeling it to be right, and the other wrong by feeling it to be wrong. But now, what particular consciousness in the universe can enjoy this prerogative of obliging others to conform to a rule which it lays down? If one of the thinkers were obviously divine, while all the others were just plain old human, there would probably be no practical dispute about the matter. The divine thought would be the model to which the others should conform. Now you know where he's going with this thing. Let me read one more little passage and we can talk about it. It would seem, he says, and this is my final conclusion, that the stable and systematic moral universe for which the ethical philosopher asks is fully possible only in a world where there is a divine thinker with all enveloping demands. If such a thinker existed, his way of subordinating the demands to one another would be the finally valid casuistic scale. His claims would be the most appealing. His ideal universe would be the most inclusive, realizable whole. If he now exists, then actualized in his thought already must be that ethical philosophy which we seek as the pattern which our own must evermore approach. And the interests of our own ideal of systematically unified moral truth, therefore, we, as would-be philosophers, must postulate a divine thinker and pray for the victory of the religious cause. So you get the big picture, right? Now, Thomas Hobbes and Leviathan, as I've said already, argued that, you know, well, the famous part argued that there's no idea of justice outside society, that once the social contract has been negotiated, it's at that point that justice comes into play. There is no such thing as justice in a state of nature, but depending on the characteristics of that particular social contract, well, certain things then will be just and certain things will be unjust. You can't assume that there is no, in other words, you can't say, well, in this society, under this social contract, that's just plain wrong. You can't say that because there is no absolute standard of justice. Thomas Hobbes is not a natural law theorist. There is no such thing as natural law existing independently of positive law. There is no such thing. Thomas Aquinas is wrong, says Hobbes. There is no divine, there's no standard out there that's purely natural law. And the same is true for good and evil. Good and evil are an independent kind of thing. As I said a minute ago, there's no such thing as absolute good or evil, but somebody willing something or diswilling something, right? But the thing is, in Hobbes, and this is the weird thing, very similar to what James is saying, the thing is, you know, if here I am, just a plain old ordinary person, and I'm living, say, in a monarchy, where, or an autocracy, where the autocrat says, you know, myself, you know, you may like baseball better than football, but I happen to like the I happen to like football better than baseball, and you know, you better adjust your opinions accordingly, right? Because I have the power to enforce what I like, and so therefore, my preferences are sort of overridden. Well, if there's a universal autocrat, that is God, the same rule holds. And so, Hobbes is a theist. I mean, Hobbes is a theologian, really. The Leviathan is half theology. People don't realize that, but it's about half theology. God is the divine autocrat, and God has certain preferences, too. And so, therefore, you might think about adjusting your preferences to the preferences of God, but not because it's somehow absolutely right or wrong, but simply because of God's completely arbitrary will. Why is it, well, as Al-Ghazali put it, Al-Ashari, you know, why is it I shouldn't lie? Because God willed that to be the case. If God had willed lying to be good, lying would be good. It's not that God is somehow conforming the divine will to some sort of absolute standard. That's the question, you know, Plato raises in Euthyphro. Is what's good good because God wills it, or does God will it because it's good? Well, the answer in the case of the voluntarists, such as Al-Ashari, Al-Ghazali, Hobbes, is it's good because God wills it, and that willing is merely arbitrary. Mm-hmm. See, God's preference. Well, James is saying the same thing, right? He's saying he's postulating a purely Hobbesian universe where there is, in the nature of things, as he puts it in quotes, there is no absolute, making sure it's still going, there is no absolute standard beyond what somebody wills. But if that somebody is the divine autocrat, then you might think about adjusting your own preferences to line up with what the divine autocrat arbitrarily wills.
Well, yeah. John, how would C.S. Lewis answer that, though? He's going beyond that and saying, seems that there is that more as if God wills it because, or God has imparted it to us because there is a greater good and evil that exists almost in the universe, and God is signing on to that too.
Mm-hmm.
Not that he it's just God's preferences.
Well, but the question is that same old Euthyphro question: does God will it because it's good, or is it good because God wills it?
And James doesn't get into that.
Well, no. James is implying it's good because God wills it. Oh, in fact, I'm more than implying. He's saying that.
Right.
Now, I don't know about. I was asking about C.S. Lewis, though. I don't know. I don't know what C.S. Lewis said.
I don't either. That's what I was wondering when you.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about it being those two levels.
Yeah.
I mean, James seems to be. Lewis seems to be assuming that what God wills or dictates is the way it is, not that it's an arbitrary choice on the part of God.
That could be. I mean, it could be Lewis comes down on the side of God wills it because it's good. But then the voluntarists would always respond, well, that demeans God's sovereignty. If God is absolutely the first cause of everything, then you got to admit, even though you may rebel against it, but still it's... It would seem to follow that the explanation is always God. And if that's the case, God's will would be merely arbitrary. Yes, Gladys?
When I think about the world, the conception of God is different depending where you grew up. And for the concept of good and evil is going to be based on that
society. That's a real problem, isn't it? I mean,
so it's not like a, which God?
Yeah.
You know, we say he and God we trust, but we don't say which God.
Yeah, yeah. That's nice fudge factor.
Very open to interpretation.
Yeah. Well, we spent a year, didn't we, talking about the Quran, you know, last year, right? And it's certainly true that not all things in the Quran line up with the way we like to interpret the Bible, anyway, the way we think we can interpret it. I mean, some do, but not everything. The values aren't completely... But if that's the word of God, you're right. That's a problem, too. I think the only difference... You know, C.S. Lewis, I think, is, and Riley Williams also, are both saying that, how do we know that telling the truth is right? And the answer was, it must be, well, because somehow God maybe instills that into us. I that's how I would take Lewis anyway, that somehow it's not the case. I portrayed it pretty harshly. I mean, I said, well, you may prefer A to B, but if God prefers B to A, you'd better adjust your willing accordingly, which, of course, is the way Hobbes is looking at it. But Lewis seems, I think, is saying, well, that our that God it sort of infuses into us the same preferences as God, and we call that conscience. In other words, conscience is the result of God's influence on our own feelings to align them with what God has, say, arbitrarily maybe, or maybe not, you know, will to be good or evil. And I think there's some of that here in James, too. I it's not maybe quite as harsh as I portrayed it in mentioning it in connection with Hobbes. Yes,
I also am one of those who don't really believe completely that all the morals come from God. There are many societies where there is not much of God influence, but they are passing those morals which have proved to be good for that society.
Yeah,
that doesn't have to. It just comes from parents to children and children and so on. Society find that a valuable criteria or norm of living, and that you continue doing that because that has proved to be the right thing to do for that society.
Yeah, right. That's a very
James doesn't care about them.
Yeah. What was that again?
James doesn't care about them. Can I offer something from the Reflex essay that's before this?
Right.
He even says specifically about the Anglo-Saxon race that he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So he's talking about, you know, the Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't care about anybody else.
Right.
He's trying to understand what the world and God would mean to the Anglo-Saxons, as he
calls
them.
Yeah.
So you could argue he's ducking the problem that of course, his audience was all the same people.
Yeah, that's the thing.
So I want to be charitable that he's focusing on a certain, as opposed to ducking the problem.
Well, I don't think he's ducking. I don't think he sees it as a problem, so he can't be ducking it if he doesn't even see it. We have a different perspective.
But I also realized that he didn't really think a great deal about what God or not God, but he did believe that it was useful for his children to go to church.
Who?
James.
Okay.
Yeah. He said, maybe, you know, maybe it's not really, I don't have to believe or not believe, but it is good for my children.
Yeah.
Because they're, and I still believe in that too, because I believe that when children hear from a priest, the same thing that you're trying to bring them up with, it's all reinforced.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I have
principle.
Yeah, I know. Now, this is not true of anybody in this class, so I can say it. But, you know, you do have people who come to church very faithfully, and then once their kids graduate from high school, you never see them again. And that means that they see the church as, they see religion as something for children. You know, that's what they,
I see.
But the fact that you all are here, and, you know, says something different. But, and that's looking at it in a, but I was going to say,
except
what you
my
said
children don't go to church.
What is it?
Because none of our children go to church.
Yeah, well, I know. I know. Isn't that weird? But
well,
that's a different story.
I know.
Anyway, but getting back to what Gladys said a minute ago, that's a very Darwinian kind of thing, yeah. You know. Yeah. And in fact, Darwin, or for that matter, E.O. Wilson? Is that the first? Is that the right Wilson? E.O. Wilson, yeah. The biologist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that right?
The study of ants. That guy.
Yeah. I mean. Well, he's of course written a bazillion books, but I read one book by him called The Social Conquest of Earth, I think, which is developing.
Sounds pleasant.
Yeah. which is developing.
He writes well.
Oh yeah, he is developing is sort of or you know it, you find it in Darwin. I mean, Darwin says that. I mean, he doesn't. I mean, he has natural selection and sexual selection. He doesn't have anything he calls social selection, but he might as well, because he does say in The Descent of Man, I think it is, that I think it's The Descent of Man, where you know societies that, or even among animals, the ones that cooperate and so forth, so that's advantageous for them. So yeah, you could give, I mean, as you just did, a very Darwinian sort of argument, this society that fosters close bonds among its members, truth-telling, affection, loyalty, self-defense, mutual defense, all those kind of things is at an advantage vis-a-vis internally divisive societies. And that's a purely, has nothing to do with theism, right? It's a purely naturalistic argument for ethics. And I do agree that that you can give those kinds of arguments too, and it doesn't mean that the only possible defense of morals is theism. I do think that's true, but James is seeming to go in a more, well, C.S. Lewis type, Riley Williams type. be sure to tell Riley I quoted him a number of times this morning. Direction, you know. So, anything else? Okay. I don't know if we. Well, I guess maybe let me start on the final argument, the mystical experience argument.
Well, can I mention this?
Sure.
Switching. I'm going to mention one other quote from the Reflex paper.
Okay.
I wrote this down because it had to do. It was one of his conclusions. It's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know where he says, you know, if you're going to be a theist, then you're agreeing that. If there's a God, it's the deepest power in the universe, so you just have to, like you said, and that it has a personality, which is, I think, partly his way of saying, you know, may have some ups and downs from your perspective, and that science can never answer all these questions about where these things came from,
uh-huh.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, he's pro-science, but he says, you know, you ain't answering all these questions.
Yeah.
But the quote is, to cooperate with his creation, God's, by the best and brightest response seems all he wants of us. The real meaning of our destiny, that is to cooperate with his creation by the best and righteous response.
Mm-hmm.
So that's his less of an autocratic statement. But, you know, God saying, God puts us here, so get with the program. And your destiny is to cooperate with the best and righteous response.
Yeah, that I don't remember that.
That sounds like a sermon.
Yeah, I don't remember that quote per se, but that sounds more like it belongs in the essay that I just read rather than.
Right. That's why I mentioned
where it comes from.
But it's from the previous one.
Yeah. And that's anyway. The kind of Hobbesian sort of thing is you better get with program.
But in a nice, gentle way, your job, you know, mm-hmm. the best and. Because there's no talk about punishment.
Right.
Saying to be right. the best person, et cetera, et cetera. Not
mm-hmm.
or else. There's no or else in there.
Right, yes. Right. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Just shows you how unsystematic James is that he can flip back and forth between ideas. all right. So the last argument. The last argument is in, by my reckoning, the two essays, one of them titled Some Hegelisms, and the other one titled Psychical... Oh, that's not the whole title. Something about psychical research. That's what's in the heading of it.
Psychotic.
What Psychical Research Has Accomplished is the name of it. and a very brief quote from some Hegelisms, maybe I won't get much farther than this. Of course, you remember that Hegel, Hegel's great claim to fame, one of them, is, of course, his whole philosophy of history, which is the unfolding of consciousness, that the meaning of history for Hegel is consciousness gradually becoming aware of itself. And in the Phenomenology of Mind, which I think admirers of Hegel take to be his greatest work, even though it was written as a fairly, he was fairly young at the time, but often those initial forays, even though they're less systematic maybe than later reflections, are often taken to be the most valuable ones, because this is the spark of genius comes through in those initial forays, if you want to think there's a spark of genius there, which I'm not inclined to think, but some people do, so I'll leave it at that. Anyway, remember we talked about Hegel, a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, I don't know how long ago it was, but the Phenomenology of Mind is a traversal through history three times from three different perspectives. The first perspective is from the point of view of science, the second perspective is from the point of view of morals, and the third perspective is from the point of view of religion. In each case, he starts back in prehistoric times and winds up, guess where? 19th century Germany. Surprise, surprise, surprise. And of course, Hegel seems to have thought that if history is a matter of consciousness with a capital C becoming aware of itself, that of course, when did consciousness finally fully become aware of itself? Well, in the philosophy of Hegel, of course, because that's what he's proclaiming to the world, right? That's what history is doing, right? So Hegel is, he's a religious philosopher in the sense that consciousness with a big C is like God, right? And there's only one of them, right? So in the metaphysical sense, or in the ontological sense, what Hegel is pushing is a monism. And you remember, and we haven't gotten to this yet, but the very last of the works of William James we're going to cover is titled A Pluralistic Universe. Not a monistic universe, but a pluralistic universe. So Hegel is William James's enemy from a metaphysical standpoint. So I'm just going to read you like two sentences and then we've got to quit. If idealism be true, he says, the great question that presents itself is whether its truth involved the necessity of an infinite, unitary, and omniscient consciousness, or whether a republic of semi-detached consciousness will do, consciousnesses united by a certain common fund of representations, but each possessing a private store which the others do not share. Either hypothesis is to me conceivable. Right? So the Hegelian hypothesis is a unitary consciousness. The Jamesian hypothesis will be the one he's going to gravitate toward, will be the pluralistic one, where we have a republic of consciousnesses that have relations to one another, but nevertheless, each one is a private individual. So I'll leave it at that. That's setting up the framework for what I'm calling the mystical argument, but the mystical argument itself is in the psychical research paper, and we'll talk about that next time. Okay? Hey. So, and it's still going.
Yeah.
Yeah.